Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, beyond the headlines with sharp insights and expert analysis from the leaders and decision makers shaping the future. So, whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, stay ahead with the stories that matter. And coming up in the next 30 minutes, there is no hiding from the tax man as SARS launches a dedicated crypto tax unit. A new report shows 60% of South Africans now prefer card payments over cash. It's a sport that's taken the country by storm, but is paddle really paying off for investors? And the changing economics of fertility treatment. The South African Revenue Service is stepping up its game when it comes to cryptocurrency taxation. It's now launched a dedicated crypto tax unit and is actively auditing taxpayers, sometimes even those who have already disclosed their crypto holdings. Letters are being sent out, I understand, and the pressure to comply is mounting. So, how exactly is SARS identifying crypto investors? What records do taxpayers need to provide? And are there risks even for those dealing in small amounts? I want to navigate this complex and I think evolving space, fast evolving space. I'm joined by Thomas Laban, tax legal specialist at Ibex Consulting, part of Latita Africa, who's been engaging directly with SARS on this issue. Thomas, a very warm welcome to you. So first of all, why has SARS decided to create this dedicated unit right now? How does it fit into broader tax enforcement trends?
Well, firstly, thanks, Jeremy. Good to be here. And to answer the question, non-compliance as far as crypto is concerned has long been an issue. And I don't think there's any doubt in anybody's mind that this is probably one of the worst single areas that taxpayers are non-compliant in. From a SARS perspective, beyond just basic compliance, of course, they also have to tackle South Africa's grey listed status, of which crypto compliance is a big part.
The question, I guess, is why there is such lax compliance. Is it simply easy to get away with at this point?
Being digital transactions, well, virtual currency as they're referred to, when crypto was first introduced back in 2009, this was something that the world hadn't really seen before. And again, the virtual nature of it made it very difficult for authorities to track, trace, and enforce the law around. Of course, regulation is slow, and what we're now seeing is that catching up to what long has been the wild west of crypto.
So, Thomas, how exactly then is SARS identifying crypto investors? Are they, for instance, working with the exchanges, or are there other tracking methods that are being employed?
Well, SARS has a full bouquet of options available to them, and they are vastly empowered to investigate and enforce non-compliance. In this case, what we've seen on the ground is SARS requesting information on certain taxpayers from the crypto exchanges in South Africa directly. Of course, they also have other tools at their disposal, comparing what goes into bank accounts to what is disclosed in tax returns. Of course, SARS isn't going to be outright with what specific means they're using to identify which taxpayers to look further into, but we know that they're well-resourced here.
Do we know how wide the current base or net is as far as crypto traders or crypto users are concerned?
Very difficult to get a certain figure on this with a good amount of authority to attach, but it has been reported recently that up to 10% of South Africa's population is or has been invested in crypto.
Wow, I would have had it a little bit lower than that. So it certainly is something that people are starting to engage with. And obviously we can see why SARS then is taking notice. Now, there is a disclosure versus audit issue here. And by that, I mean some taxpayers who have already disclosed their holdings are still being audited. One, Thomas, can you confirm this? And two, if that is the case, is this a sign of increased scrutiny across the board?
Look, factually, it is the case, and I've personally seen one of those matters. Now, in those cases, it does appear at this point to be a timing issue, when SARS receives that information and compares against a return, and then the time elapsed until that taxpayer corrects the situation in the relevant return. So, where you've corrected that situation and you've disclosed your crypto transactions, but the crypto unit has already received information on you, you'll be hearing from them anyway.
So are there then, in that respect, specific records that crypto investors need to maintain to ensure compliance?
Firstly, Jeremy, a taxpayer needs to retain their records for 5 years after an assessment is issued by SARS, but it's always a good idea to keep your records afterwards anyway, because SARS can go back and ask you for that. And on the specific records that SARS wants, finally, we have a bit of good clarity directly from SARS on the matter. You see, you get what are called CSV files or comma separated value files, essentially Excel transaction histories that you can get from each of your exchanges or crypto wallets. And that's exactly what SARS wants to see without any manipulation. Beyond that, SARS also wants to know what your wallet IDs are, essentially your wallet addresses, so that they can track and trace your transactions themselves to verify that what you give them is correct. And then the last piece of the puzzle, is a PDF statement if the exchange provides it. That's a big thing that SARS likes to see.
I also think there might be a bit of a misnomer here. A lot of people might think that SARS is only going after big players, but I'm assuming that small crypto traders would also be at the risk of audits and penalties.
Absolutely. You know, if you've been drinking and you go through a roadblock, it doesn't matter if you're driving a Toyota Taz or a Ferrari California, you're still breaking the law. And that does seem to be the approach that SARS is taking. Now, of course, they'll want to go after those so-called whales more than anybody else. But at the same time, small instances of non-compliance can very quickly snowball.
Let's assume, Thomas, that someone has crypto holdings that were previously undeclared. What's the best course of action then to avoid any kind of penalty?
Depends on how long ago the return was filed, if it was filed at all, and then whether it was verified or not. So the easiest route for taxpayers on small amounts can be an additional assessment request that you have your practitioner, or if you're savvy enough, you submit to SARS. To ask to be taxed on a further amount. But generally, what's a good idea for taxpayers to do is take advantage of the SARS Voluntary Disclosure Program, or VDP, which is essentially SARS' amnesty program. And that allows you to either avoid completely or mitigate penalties quite substantially and completely avoid criminal prosecution. And it's sensitive. And one of the biggest requirements around the VDP, Jeremy, is that it must be voluntary. So if you've already been contacted by SARS audit unit, it's either a warning letter where they invite you to submit a VDP application, tenuous enough as it is. But if you've been notified by SARS audit unit or crypto unit from the risk augmentation, sorry, revenue augmentation unit, essentially risk audits, it's too late. Your only option then is to cooperate with them and give them what they require, and then see if there is any discussion to be held about around the penalties that they want to impose, which, by the way, are standing at 100%, it seems.
And just a quick answer in conclusion, to the best of your knowledge, have there been any landmark cases in this country yet where a taxpayer has successfully challenged SARS on crypto taxation?
None that have been ventilated through the court, but I do see it coming fairly soon.
Thomas Laban, thank you very much indeed. Tax specialist at Ibex Consulting, part of Latita Africa. I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, cash may still be king in some circles, but South Africa's digital payment landscape is evolving rapidly. A new Visa report highlighting a major shift, with two-thirds of merchants and nearly 60% of consumers now preferring card payments. While this signals growth opportunities for businesses, I guess challenges like fraud concerns and transaction costs do remain. So let's break all of this down. I'm in conversation with Lineshri Mudli, who's the country head for Visa South Africa. Lineshri, welcome and thank you very much indeed. So your study shows a strong preference now for card payments. I guess we shouldn't be too surprised, but what are the key factors that are behind this trend?
We certainly have seen a thriving digital payment ecosystem which is emerging in South Africa, both consumers and merchants. In the recent survey that we've done, we've seen two-thirds of merchants and nearly 60% of consumers say that they prefer card payments. We've also seen e-commerce merchants, about 80% of them, ready to accept online payments. So what is driving this? I think the first one is concerns around cash. And there's multiple areas, you know, ranging from risk of being robbed to employees stealing money. I think the other area is SMEs are starting to realize once they come into the digital financial ecosystem, there is a trace of the transactions that they do. And, you know, be it banks or fintechs are able to then provide access to credit that allows them to grow and scale their businesses. And I think the other part of it is the convenience of taking card payments. And perhaps the last point I'll make is often we are finding that people are wanting to pay by card and there's lost sales if they're only taking cash.
Lineshri, what do you think this long-term means for the future of cash then?
I think that we will see a reduction of cash in the long term. I think if you look at Africa and, you know, specifically South Africa, we've certainly seen digital payments accelerate. Contactless payments now make up over 60% of all payments in South Africa. You know, I've mentioned some of the numbers in terms of preference of merchants to use digital payments. And I think all of this contributes to growth of the economy, because when you bring more small businesses, you don't just make them more efficient and prosperous, you uplift the community. And ultimately, digitizing helps the economies grow.
I also note from your report that SMEs are adopting digital payments increasing with increasing energy. Why do you think that is? This is not something that is just centered on established businesses, isn't it? It's right down the value chain.
Absolutely. So again, here I think there's a few points. One is the concerns that are faced with cash, and I mentioned some of the reasons around that in terms of risk of robbery, you know, employees. I think that the second one is when you're looking at advantages. As a business, they're able to get access to finance or to credit to allow them to grow their businesses. And what I mean by this is when there's transparency on the transaction and you can see the types of transactions that are going through, the amounts, etc., you're able to actually afford credit, which allows them to grow their businesses. I think the ease at which they can also manage inventory. And also there's better management as opposed to when you're managing huge amount of cash.
Having said that, though, fraud and security concerns do remain a challenge. How can businesses and consumers mitigate the risks, and what is a platform like Visa doing about it?
So I think when it comes to fraud and risk, I mean, it's something from the Visa perspective that we invest significantly. I think we've invested over $10 billion globally in the last 5 years to manage risk that emerges within the digital payment space. There are multiple tools that we bring that, you know, SMEs as well as businesses can use. I think over and above that, consumer education is really quite key in terms of highlighting, you know, how you use a card, how not to compromise your passwords and those types of things. So I think those are the two things, the risk and fraud tools we bring into the environment, being able to manage the consumer education, and really working as an ecosystem to bring together solutions as we see fraud coming in on certain areas as digital payment starts to advance.
Do you think you're making sufficient progress in that respect?
I think so. I think using technologies like AI has, you know, really been able to help us, like from a global perspective and using global data sets, to be able to better predict fraud and to help businesses. And ultimately, I think moving into the digital space and with new technologies like tokenization, et cetera, we're able to manage the fraud that comes with increased digital interactions.
There is no doubt, Lineshni, that the train is moving very quickly in this respect. But transaction fees are often cited as a barrier. Are there solutions to make digital payments more cost effective?
Absolutely. I think that is one of the findings that actually came out of the research reports. I think I want to answer that in two ways. The one is looking at the value of actually coming into the digital ecosystem and what it provides you for the cost that you're actually going to pay for that transaction. So it's all the transparency in terms of how you manage your inventory. It's some of the value-added services like bringing loyalty, which we know SMEs, et cetera, want. And then there's the other part of it, which is looking at how do you bring low-cost acceptance to SMEs, especially, you know, the SMEs in the nano and micro space. And we're looking at technologies there like tap-to-phone, where you actually, instead of going out and procuring, you know, POS devices, you can actually turn your own mobile phone into a way to take payments. So then obviously there's when you're looking at the actual fees, it's about looking at how can we together as an ecosystem come together to lower those prices that the merchants are paying.
Again, I ask you, do you think you're making enough progress in that respect?
I think that we are, and I think you have to look at that in the overall context of value as well, in terms of what you're paying versus the additional benefit you're getting in having to be able to do the digital transaction. I think some of the key advancements come in the ability to grow your businesses and the other services that you are able to unlock through digital payments.
And just a quick one, you mentioned mobile payments. Obviously, mobile payment and digital wallets are gaining traction. Are we getting to the point, the inflection point, where they will overtake traditional card transactions?
I think that we are absolutely seeing digital wallets and digital payments that are, and they're growing at a much faster rate. And we see that, right, as you start to accept more types of payments like your Apple Pay, Samsung Pay, etc. I think that there will come a time where being able to pay on a wearable, whether it's your phone or your watch or a ring, will start to overtake the traditional form factor of just using a card.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Lineshri Mudli, Country Head for Visa South Africa.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, infertility rates, I read, are rising globally, with the market for fertility treatments expected, would you believe, to double by 2026. In South Africa, one in five couples faces fertility challenges, yet access to the treatment often remains limited. I want to discuss the trends, the obstacles, and maybe even the innovations in fertility care. And I'm in conversation now with Ashley Bourguignon from Next Biosciences. Ashley, a very warm welcome. So I guess the obvious question is, why is infertility on the rise globally, and how do we compare in this country to others?
It's a great question. So it's also a really challenging question. I think the rise in infertility rates is influenced by a combination of things. It's a conversation that, you know, I think is opening up. And as a result, the perception is that it's on the rise. It is on the rise, but the conversation is also opening up as a result, which is good. It's what we want. There are a number of factors that would contribute to the rise in South Africa and the rise globally as well. For example, things like delayed childbearing. I think we're seeing with the millennials coming through and reaching that childbearing age, more individuals are choosing to have children later in life due to career, financial, or personal reasons. Typically, fertility declines with age, particularly for women over the age of 35. Other things like lifestyle factors, poor diet, obesity, malnutrition, excessive alcohol consumption, these kind of things have been known to impact fertility, sperm quality, and sperm count. And then we've obviously got one that I think we are very, very familiar with, which is something which is increased stress levels. The pressures of modern life, financial strain, work-related stresses can disrupt that hormonal balance. As far as South Africa trending, I think we have a higher prevalence of things like sexually transmitted infections, which contribute to fertility, because that STI will cause an inflammation in the uterus. So, you know, I think globally it's on the rise. South Africa, we're on the rise. It's fairly comparable, but there's a number of factors, and it's quite complicated in terms of the things that are contributing to this rise globally.
And Ashley, of course, there are solutions here, but they do come at a cost.
Absolutely. There are solutions. Things like IVF, IUIs, these kind of solutions are available. They are very pricey, and they're not always, you know, a common misconception is that IVF is a dead cert in terms of getting you to a point where you are pregnant. IVF has definitely made big strides in terms of getting you to the point where you can have a child with medication and assisted reproduction. But it's not a hard and fast rule that you will be pregnant if you undergo IVF.
So beyond IVF, Ashley, what other solutions exist?
Jeremy, I think people need to, early diagnosis is a good one. Like any kind of medical treatment or any kind of medical intervention, the earlier you diagnose and the earlier you can intervene and treat, the better. And education, people need to be aware of things like STIs, aware of the spread of things like STIs. And really, so it's a bit of a combination. I think people generally are quite reactive in terms of their healthcare, and that's not a reproductive thing, it's an overall thing. And really, you need to be proactive with your reproductive health. You need to make sure that you're seeing a doctor and having the right conversations before you feel like there's something wrong, because the early intervention, some of these things are asymptomatic. So the earlier you catch them and the earlier you can intervene, the better.
Given that this is very much an economic debate, are there partnerships with medical aids that can make treatment more financially accessible?
Definitely, definitely. And it's something that Next Biosciences is really focused on. We are constantly lobbying with the medical funders to try and get access to this type of testing. We've come a long way since the inception of this, of reproductive health with Next Biosciences. We've done a lot of lobbying. We've got a lot of coverage for a lot of the tests that we offer. Really, what the medical aides are looking for is local data. Because we've tested and been around in the market for over 10 years, we are really in a good position to provide that data that supports the type of coverage that we're looking for better access.
But until there's a change of mind or a change of strategy as far as the medical aids are concerned, for many people, this will remain beyond the pocket.
Yes, you spot on. It is beyond the pocket. You know, Next Biosciences tries to do what they can in terms of offering things like payment plans to make the cost of these tests a little bit more manageable and a little bit more kind of chunked up, so that, you know, you can afford it over the course of a few months. So that's what we need to try and do from our side. But yes, it is out of pocket, and it can be quite strenuous from a financial perspective.
Ashley, I'm going to take a bit of a leap here, but I'm going to suggest that in South Africa, cultural stigma might still surround infertility. Does that impact in any way on treatment uptake?
Definitely, Jeremy. I think the stigma is there, absolutely, particularly around male fertility. The conversation is simply not happening. So thank you so much for having this conversation with me and for being open to it. The more the conversation opens up, hopefully the more we can have the conversation and the more we can educate on the uptake of this type of testing, more so that the type of testing actually exists in the first place. You know, if you educate people, you're empowering them with the information to really take their reproductive health into their own hands and have the right conversations with their healthcare practitioners. So the stigma is there. We're working on it. Hopefully conversations like this help change that too.
And Ashley, we've spoken about medical aids, but what role does government policy play, if at all, in improving access to fertility treatments? Is this on anyone's agenda?
It's a very challenging question. I think there are government IVF centers in South Africa. I think, unfortunately, the government has got bigger fish to fry in terms of the disease burden in South Africa. I think things like HIV and TB are a lot higher on their agenda. I really hope that these conversations are happening amongst the government kind of healthcare sector, but it's probably not at the level or not at the kind of frequency that we would like it to be. We will continue to try and educate where we can. We've got lots of education initiatives that target the registrars, so people that are coming out of their gynae and obstetrician kind of learnings and university space, the healthcare practitioners there, to hopefully educate them so that they know that this type of testing is available. Beyond that, we will continue. We're fighting the good fight with the medical aids, and we'll continue fighting the good fight with the governments as well.
Ashley Bourguignon from Next Biosciences, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, paddle fever has officially taken hold in South Africa. It's the country's fastest growing and I understand most mispronounced sport. We're going to get into that in just a moment. Now, since arriving here in 2020, if I'm not mistaken, this hybrid of squash and tennis really has exploded. Listen to this. Over 100,000 players, 206 clubs, 600 courts, mostly concentrated in the affluent areas of Gauteng and the Western Cape. But while the courts are full and the sport is booming, there's a bigger question at play here. Is this a sustainable investment or another short-lived trend? Investors are piling in, but are they making smart long-term bets or about find themselves in a financial pickle? And you'll excuse the pun there. So let's separate fact from hype. We're joined by Brandon de Kock. He's been on the program with us before, director of storytelling at data research company BrandMap, and he's been tracking the numbers behind South Africa's boom in the sport. Brandon, a very warm welcome. Let's settle it first. How do we pronounce this?
Hi there, Jeremy. Well, that's a good one. You know, I remember having dinner a while back when somebody said that they'd just come back from the Himalayas and getting into a feverish argument about the Himalayas or the Himalayas.
Yeah.
I think technically it is padel, yeah, but only if you're Spanish. I think paddle is probably better. Technically, it would be padel, but come on. I mean, sure. I think we can all just call it paddle. It sounds a bit better. Rolls off the tongue a little easier.
Yeah, otherwise I was going to have to put a lisp on every question I asked you, which would have been very difficult. So let's settle on paddle. But seriously, though, the rapid growth of the sport is undeniable. But the question is, a long-term trend, or like so many other things we've seen, is it just a social craze that could fizzle out?
Yeah, it's a million-dollar question or the million-rand question, because the reality is that it's coming off a tiny base, right? I mean, you're talking about, we only started measuring it for the first time about 3 years ago. And out of the whole brand map audience, so that's, you know, 13.5 million consumer class South Africans, less than 1% even ticked a box to say they were interested in it. Right now, we're sitting at about 4-4.5% of people saying that they're actually playing. So that number right now is probably sitting, we're estimating it at probably just over 300,000, maybe between 300 and 350,000 active players. Mm. It's not a huge amount. It's still a very elite sport, you know? So my simple answer to the question is, if it breaks out of the wealthy suburbs, you know, the places where you can turn tennis courts into paddle courts, or you can turn the old bowling greens into paddle courts, I think it's got a super good chance. You know, it's that's what's happened in South America and a lot of countries. But in some of the sort of Scandi countries and the more wealthy European places, it looks like it's stuck in the elite, and it seems stuck in the elite right here. So right now, the way things are going, it might be pushing up against a ceiling. It'll be really interesting to see what happens if the game expands out of the leafy suburbs, though.
So what you're also telling me is that potentially there is untapped demand, but something's got to change within the dynamic.
Yeah, I think so. You know, when we first started tracking, the real story was all about the Gauteng versus Cape Town thing. So, you know, the game started officially in Cape Town. When I say Cape Town, it started at Val d'Avie Golf Estate. You know, it's hardly a lower middle income area.
I was gonna say, go figure,
Yeah, exactly. So Cape Town, 2 years ago, Cape Town had a disproportionate amount of paddle players relative to the rest of the country. Over the course of last year, we started tracking where the new courts are being built. And there's 100% validation of the theory that paddle abhors a vacuum, clearly, because what we've seen is where all the courts were being built, the players have been sucked up into them. So we now see an almost 100% correlation between the provincial spread of paddle players and where the courts actually are. So yeah, I think it's probably reaching the point now where it may be saturated. That's certainly from some of the reports I'm reading. There are paddle court owners who are perhaps a little disappointed in the fact that they're not booked up, you know, 12 operating hours of the day. Then you hear other stories from country clubs. I was at Bryanston 2 weeks ago, And, you know, you've got to book 2 months ahead at Bryanston, apparently, to get a weekend paddle slot. So, yeah, I think where it sits right now, it's maybe reaching some sort of a ceiling, but cheapest, you know, there's so much room for growth.
So let's talk about that growth. Do you have a view on how it could expand out of the so-called elite areas achieve a wider footprint?
Yeah, I think it's like a McDonald's. You know, if you build it, they will come. I think the barriers to entry for the game are relatively low. You know, it's not, you don't need a high level of skill to be able to play the game and enjoy it. It's not golf. You know, it's not even tennis. It's a different sport completely. So the barrier to entry on a skill level is very low. The cost is not prohibitive. You know, a couple of $100 for 4 people to book a court. I certainly think there's scope to start getting lower down the income triangle. But you've got to build the courts where people can get to them. Right now, it still seems to me, I don't have a really good view of the whole footprint, but it does seem to me that I'm not driving through sort of, the township areas and seeing a lot of paddle courts going up. So that's what the mechanism, super simple, like build the courts in places where people can access them, keep the cost relatively low. And well, not relatively low, but just accessible. Mm. And I think the game's got a good chance, you know.
But having said that, the courts themselves, I understand, are not cheap to build.
Well, as far as I know, it's about a single court's probably about half a bar, and there's a sort of a scale of economy going up from that. So I've heard figures of sort of 1.2 million rand for a 3-court setup. So yes, that's a proper investment. But if you put the thing in the right place where there's frequent foot flow or frequent padel flow, there's no reason why it shouldn't be a decent business, you know.
And just a quick one: a lot of new leisure sports start to thrive when corporates get involved. Are we at the point where major brands and sponsors are placing a bet on this?
Jeremy, we published a thing called the Paddle Report, which we've sold multiple times now, and it's all to top-end brands and top-end plays. I think there's an immediate recognition that it's almost like the paddle ball seems to have taken a big chunk out of the, let's call it the golfer mountain biking market. I don't know whether it's taking a chunk out of it. I think it's in addition to. So it still is something, you know, you still have to have the time on your hands to get in your car and drive to a paddleball court. It's still an elite activity in the sense that you need the time apart from anything to be able to do it. But yes, right now it seems like it's your sort of the financial brands and a bit of banking and a bit of investment and premium goods and services seem to be taking a serious interest.
It just leaves me to say, Brandon, gracias. And appreciate your time, Director of Storytelling and Data Research at the company BrandMap. And that's our program for today. We're back on Monday with another 30 minutes looking at issues driving South Africa's business, political and social environment. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.